The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. Coming up.
For most people, we've got terabytes of storage now, so the reason to store a lot of MP3s isn't quite there. Everyone's got plenty of space, really, to store thousands of studio masters.
Is the era of the MP3 music download approaching an end? Samuel Gibbs meets Linz Gilad Tiefenbrum to discover the future of music. Also, WikiLeaks' Julian Assange holds a press conference in which very little is said. Is he still relevant in the post-Snowden era? Search engine giant Google buys Jetpack. What's that? Don't dismiss it as an everyday travel app. Stick around to hear more about Google's latest foray into our deep, deep minds. And Flappy Bird's creator launches his new game. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Neither. It's the equally infuriating Swingcopters. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
And confirms that I am leaving the embassy soon. But perhaps not for the reasons that the Murdoch press and Sky News are saying at the moment.
WikiLeaks' Julian Assange there, confirming he will be leaving the Ecuadorian embassy soon, but refuting the reasons that have been reported. I'm joined in the studio by Charles Arthur and Alex Hearn. Charles, it's been 2 years since Assange sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. I just want to be clear about this. He's been hiding there to avoid being sent to Sweden to be questioned regarding claims of sexual abuse. When and why will he leave now?
The answer soon seems to be the best that we're getting, and no one actually knows when soon is, possibly not even including Assange himself. And as for the why, again, it's really very unclear, isn't it?
Well, some people say that he's sick and that he has to leave.
Yeah, but that's not sort of going to get him out of the fact that there's an extradition warrant for him, which will, once he's on UK soil, will mean that he's liable for arrest. So unless they have some interesting way, such as taking him out in the diplomatic bag, which I think would constitute a breach of the use of the diplomatic bag.
So there's official uses of the diplomatic bag. Cannot carry a human.
Mostly not for transporting bodies.
Alive or otherwise.
Yeah, indeed. Then it's going to be pretty hard for him not to set foot onto British soil.
So why on earth did he announce that he may leave, or that he's planning on leaving, or that leaving is possibly in his future soon?
One has to suspect that the idea is to get a lot of publicity around him leaving, which would then mean that if the police try to arrest him and exercise the warrant, that there will be an almighty hoo-ha and that things will then be delayed again.
So would you argue then that this is yet another part of the stable of Assange's media plan? I found it interesting that in the article that was written on The Guardian's website, it actually says that he knowingly grew a beard. This was reported in the Mail on Sunday. He knowingly grew a beard because that would indicate that time had passed. Well done. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm so incredibly cynical about this story, and I'm trying to be professional by not being so cynical. But ultimately, Charles, hasn't the U.S. already had its sacrificial WikiLeaks lamb in Chelsea Manning, formerly Bradley Manning?
But this isn't about the U.S. I mean, the way that it's always been about is that there's an extradition warrant to Sweden, supporters of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange particularly have always claimed that there's a secret extradition warrant which would be served if Assange arrived in Sweden, which would then extradite him from Sweden to the US. There's no evidence that anyone has ever brought that actually suggests that such a warrant exists. In the absence of that, you have to say, well, it's all a bit paranoid, perhaps, though sometimes people's paranoia is justified when it comes to the US and extraterritorial claims that it makes.
And in fact, you know, the Ecuadorian ambassador did make a statement. He said that Assange has been suffering persecution of a political nature due to his activities as a journalist. As far as I can see, as we've already said, that's not exactly why he has been hiding out in the embassy. I mean, perhaps that's his reason for hiding out in the embassy, but legally, that's not actually the reason, is it, Charles?
Well, sure, but his reason for not going to Sweden is because he fears being extradited to the US, along with, I suspect, any concerns he might have about what the Swedish justice system would do to him. So there's a sort of a double layer to it.
But Alex, is this actually still relevant in a post-Snowden era? Is what the cables said, is that not already sort of entrenched in our knowledge of international diplomacy and non-diplomacy?
I think the information released in the WikiLeaks cables is still very much relevant. That source of information keeps bubbling up because although the foreign situation changes, although the state of the world changes, being able to point to what was happening internally at a time which, you know, is now getting steadily further into the past, is still very useful. I think, though, Assange's relevance is much, much diminished from that time. The cables are out there. I mean, the great thing about WikiLeaks was that once the cables were out there, it had nothing to do with Assange, how they were used, what they were used for. He gave up that power over them in releasing them. The soon statement I find very interesting because shortly after he made that, the WikiLeaks spokesman said he was ready to leave at any moment if the UK allowed safe passage, but had no plans to hand himself in. In other words, the soon statement is exactly the same as it has been for the last 2 years. I think, in terms of it being a media plan, I think some of it is just after a couple of years, if the attention fades, it gets very scary being in there. Assange is by no means the person who stayed the longest in an embassy. Ethiopia's foreign minister is still in the Italian embassy in Addis Ababa, where he entered in 1991, and he has not left.
Do you think that this is a reaction to a perceived psychological threat from the popularity or at least the media attention of other whistleblowers, like, for example, Edward Snowden or subsequent whistleblowers that have been rumored, NSA whistleblowers that have been rumored since the Snowden leak, since the release of the information from the NSA?
I think certainly the existence of future whistleblowers does mean that fear of fading into nothing and just being left in the embassy grows. If Assange were in the situation he was in 2010, where he was still joint with Manning as the most famous leaker in the world, he could possibly be confident that attention would stay on him, that his plight would be, you know, front page news every anniversary. As it is, I think with Edward Snowden and then with this purported second leaker still in the NSA, yeah, I mean, Assange has got to feel eyes turning away from him.
Charles, what of this second leaker? Do we know anything about him, her?
No, we don't. But their existence has sort of been triangulated, rather like the way that astronomers figure out that there's a planet around a distant sun. You know, you can tell by the character of the information that has been coming through to various news sources. It's not from Snowden. It's not from WikiLeaks. It's not from Chelsea Manning. And by that fact, one has to sort of figure that it must come from an NSA source because of the quality of the information.
Well, we shall keep our eyes on this at theguardian.com/technology is where everything will be reported for more on this story as it unfolds. Google continues to consume clever startups, and this week they announced that the company has purchased the city guide service Jetpack. But they don't really want to get into the travel game. After all, they dabbled a few years ago when they bought Fromers and then they sold it back to the family who started it just, I think, a year or so later. So, Charles, what is Jetpack and why has Google, hoovered them up.
So Jetpack is a small startup whose chief technology officer, co-founder, is a guy called Pete Warden, who used to work at Apple. He's also the guy behind Open Heat Map, which is a great way of representing, if you had some data about different countries, say the distribution of smartphones in different countries, you could load it into a CSV file, upload it to the heat map, and you'd get a fantastic representation showing how they were used there. So Pete's a really smart guy. And one of the things that he was trying to do with Jetpack was to do city guides, which would tell you where are the hip places to go in San Francisco or Belfast or, you know, any city that you care to name. And they figured rather than, you know, doing all the boring stuff of walking around and asking people, so boring, that they would instead use the publicly available data from all the photos that people have taken with location tags and use that to create a city guide of a different sort. What they then thought about was, well, okay, so how do we figure out what the useful things, you know, what's the useful data in this? So Pete developed a neural network system which could take a whole raft of photos in, millions of photos, and analyze them for things like, hey, are the people in that photo wearing mustaches? Is there blue sky in the view? Are they smiling? Are they wearing lipstick? Where are they? And do they look happy? Do they look sad? Do they look like they've got a fantastic vista? And using these sorts of things, they said, well, what are the hippest places in San Francisco by the number of mustaches and sort of hipster hairstyles and stuff? What are the places with great views? What are the places with great hikes? And it's essentially a sort of machine-generated set of city guides. You know, certain amount of human interaction, but they tried to minimize that, tried to lean as much as they could on the public data that's available through all the sources like Instagram and Flickr.
You mentioned neural networks. I know of that just literally from neurobiology.
In your head.
Yeah, exactly. The stuff that actually happens in my head. Yes, it's electrical pulses, but in fact, it's sort of biologically engineered electrical pulses. What do you mean by neural networks in this context?
So in computing terms, a neural network is a set of interconnected inputs and outputs. So you input a photo and you say, okay, tell me if this has got a mustache in it. And you look at the outputs, and if it's identified five photos where someone's got a mustache and one photo where they haven't, you say, no, that one was wrong. And you give that feedback back to it. And the algorithms that work on it adjust themselves, so they dynamically change according to the feedback that you give them and the inputs that you're giving them. And eventually you get to the point where they can recognize faces, they can recognize objects, they can analyze in real time using internet connections and the power of smartphones and give you a fairly good guess of, for example, what they're looking at. So one of the things that Jetpack did, and which is still available for download from the iTunes store, is a thing called Spotter, an app called Spotter, which if you use it, takes the camera on your iPhone, and you point it at an object, and it will give you its estimate of what it is that you're pointing it at. And it's pretty good with things like computers. I pointed it at my coffee mug the other day, and it said, could be a coffee mug, could be a bucket, which I think was actually not bad because the handle was in view. You know, it says, okay, it's sort of large and round, it's got a hole in the top.
And Charles, what happened when you pointed it at me?
When I pointed it at you, it said, could be an iron, could be a microphone,
could be a traffic light.
It wasn't sure. Yeah, it was. I pointed at Alex, and it said 6% chance it's a house finch, which I think is not bad. Actually.
That's actually not so bad. Yeah. It's the wings, isn't the flappy wings.
He is sort of 6% composed of house finches. So that's a neural network in action. And
are there other apps? Are there other services that have used these types of neural networks? Because what it sounds to me like is it's an exercise in a kind of a learning AI. Is that in some what it would be? And where has this kind of thing been used elsewhere?
So neural networks were quite big in the 80s. They thought that they were going to be, the way forward in computing. Problem was that it turned out the amount of data available and the amount of computing power available just wasn't sufficient. So they really went into a decline in terms of the effort people put into them for about 20 years or so. More recently, they've come back. So, for example, AnkiDrive, who we had in here a few weeks ago, that uses neural networks so that the cars can get smarter. The cars are able to navigate themselves around. They have a sort of an inbuilt intelligence. and the cars improve as they get used more and more. Microsoft uses it with Skype for its auto-translation. That's a neural network system. And Google is very interested in it for things like Google Now and other intelligent assistants. So, yeah, neural networks are having quite a big revival, and there's a lot of effort going into using them well, because what's changed is that computing power has increased exponentially, as it does, but also the amount of data that you can throw into these things has increased enormously compared to what it was. I mean, you know, Instagram is now generating about 5 million photos every day which have location data. And if you're trying to do a city guide sort of system, having location data is really, really useful.
Well, we have spoken about Flickr and how Flickr is another source for Jetpack. But how many people still use Flickr? As far as I was aware, its use was declining.
It doesn't matter really, because all you want to have is a data source. You don't mind how many are adding to it, because there's a lot of photos already there, and if you can trawl across them and dig out the ones with location data, dig out the ones that have been recommended, then it's all useful.
But what if it's an old database? So, you know, the number of mustaches in a particular part of Washington, D.C., for example, that may have moved once, I don't know, gentrification happened and the hipsters wanted to go further afield from where the in 2009 those photographs were taken. So
it's okay, you look at the date.
So there is a date. There's a date associated.
There's always
dates
associated with these things. It's all in the EXIF data. Yeah, it's not a problem.
There was a comment in the comment section of the article that you wrote on theguardian.com from Grant Hinner, and he says, people post photos to show that they are living the dream and how they're having so much fun. But in actual fact, the psychological drivers may be the opposite. Put another way, they are seemingly creating this impression for the benefit of others to see when in actual fact it is for themselves. That is, and there's a lot of twists and turns in this, obviously. It's an attempt to feel better about whatever it is that they're doing, where they are in life. Though obviously without knowing the ins and outs of the algorithms that they use, it seems the app developers have a kind of confused correlation versus causation. Have we actually got a logical fallacy here? Is this something that, you know, that the correlation is simply two things that are associated rather than causal?
Well, I think that that comment is referring to a study that Jetpack did early in the year, which suggested that Belfast is the happiest city in the UK, and they identified sort of the ground zero of happiness, which was a particular bar, based on the number of photos. And that was to do with how many photos came out of that bar, how happy the people in it looked compared to other areas. And you could argue that, oh, people are, you know, of course they're happy in it because they're in the bar. You know, lots of them are young. Fine, but you know, it's the volume of photos will count as well. But that's not the important thing about Jetpack for Google. What's really important is the fact that it can apply these algorithms, neural networks, to photos and say, hey, that thing in that photo is this. You know, it's not about Google doesn't really, I don't think, care about city guides that much. It's much more interested in saying, hey, this photo is a such and such. And in effect, being able to do auto tagging where you don't have to get involved in it at all. You know, that would be the ideal for Google. Because don't forget, you know, they have this mission, which is organize the world's information and make it useful. And if they can get into photos, if they can start understanding what is in photos, that's a huge leap. Because at the moment, image search on any search engine is pretty hit and miss. It tends to be related to the text that surrounds the photo, you know, that's attached to the article where the photo appears. If you just have a page that's got a photo and no description of the photo, no sort of header tags or anything, then it will tend to go, I've no idea what that is. But if you're able to apply that to all the photos in your database and it says, oh yeah, that photo which has no surrounding meta tags, anything to do with it, that's actually a photo of a lighthouse, that's useful.
Well, what we have here in this one story actually is an interesting confluence of the four biggies in web in Silicon Valley. We've got Google buying Jetpack, which is, you know, a former Apple employee. Flickr, which is one of the sources, is owned by Yahoo. Instagram is owned by Facebook. Currently, its Jetpack is available on the Apple iOS device.
In fact, only in the Apple store. They didn't have an Android version.
And it soon won't be available. Mm. So, I mean, this is, what implications does this have for these relationships, for where Jetpack can suck its information? Or is that actually relevant? Is it because it's open data? Who the heck cares?
I don't think the Jetpack is going to continue offering its city guides. They're going to cease doing the app. And I suspect that actually that's not Google's core aim, because they can lean more effectively on what other people do. You know, I mean, you mentioned the Frommer's guides, which they bought in August and then sold in the next April. You know, I suspect that they sucked those dry, and those are all living inside the Google database now. So that information's simple enough, but it's the neural network, it's the skills which they find useful. One interesting thing, though, is that Pete Warden has made the code behind the Spotter app and another related app called Deep Belief, which you can use. You can use it to identify an object, and then you can have it look at other objects and say, is this the same sort of object or is it different? And it's, you know, quite good at distinguishing the similarity differences. Again, it's a neural network you can train. He's made that code available on GitHub, so anyone who wants to write a Spotter style app, who wants to, you know, dabble in neural networks, it's all there. It's all available. So you know, it's not locked away inside Google.
For more on this and all of Google's news, go to theguardian.com/technology. Fans of Breaking Bad will understand this reference. If Walter White had created a mobile game, surely it would have been this. Flappy Birds is the blue sky of the gaming world, another reference that's methadone for the rest of us, and it was the brainchild of the surely unaccountably evil mind of Dong Nguyen, a bedroom games developer from Vietnam. So compulsive, it became an international hit until, according to Nguyen, he pulled it from the Apple Store to stop people from becoming addicted to it. Alrighty, digital crackheads, get ready for his new creation. It's about to be launched, and it sounds like this. That is Swingcopters. Alex, what is Swingcopters?
So it's Flappy Birds, right? But you go up.
Uh-huh. And you're a helicopter.
I'm compelled already.
It is unquestionably a follow-up to Flappy Bird. It has the same lo-fi aesthetic. It has the same apparently rock-hard gameplay. The app is to be released in a week or so. But yeah, rather than going sideways and jumping through pipes, you're going up, avoiding hammers, and tapping to move left or right with your little helicopter-hatted bird thing.
So one of the things that I've been reading about it is that whereas Flappy Bird had gravity that mm-hmm. kept pulling you down, this does not have gravity. It right. has another mechanic.
Right. The mechanic is essentially that you move to the left until you tap to move to the right, and vice versa. It really is that simple. In its own way, I mean, that's the right way to make a follow-up to Flappy Bird. The question is whether it's different enough to spark the same appeal.
Well, remind me a little bit about the hubbub, the furore, the overwhelming din of Flappy Bird when it was climbing, nay, sprinting up the Apple charts.
Well, yes. For most people, Flappy Bird was one of those things which they hadn't heard of until suddenly it was everywhere. The actual spark for its rise up the app chart seems to have been a playthrough that YouTuber PewDiePie did of it in early this year. It is a rock hard game which involves, yeah, avoiding pipes, playing as a little bird. It's simple as all hell. The minute it came out, coders left, right and center were saying, I could have done that. But as is the way with all these things,
They didn't.
Flappy Bird, if you take it out of what it is, it's a very pretty game. It has callbacks aesthetically to games like Super Mario. But at the same time, there is original design. The bird icon itself is gorgeous. Some aspects of its simplicity do seem to be genuinely simplicity for simplicity's sake. For instance, the famous lack of parallax scrolling in the background, which means that the graphics make it rather unclear as to whether the bird is flying forward or the ground is moving towards it. That doesn't seem to be an aesthetic choice so much as a choice driven by the fact that parallax scrolling is hard to implement. But then, who am I to say? And Dong Nguyen, once the app came out, immediately got rather quiet about the whole thing, apparently because he was terrified by the reaction.
And also there was some off the record conversations amongst the three of us about, you know, what was it that shot it up the charts? Was it to do with its actual popularity? As you said, PewDiePie had done a playthrough on YouTube. Or was it something to do a little bit more insidious with gaming the charts on the iTunes App Store?
Right. And this is one of those questions which seems likely to stay forever unanswered, at least unless Dong Nguyen decides to come clean if he did it, or if someone manages to prove that he did it, or if he finds some way to prove that he didn't. None of those things seem particularly likely, and it's not really something that's easy to work out reverse engineered, particularly if all you have to look at is the App Store charts.
But I think also it's not important, you know, to be honest. You know, it might have been important back at the sort of very early point, but once the game was out in front of people, people said, you know what, this actually is a pretty compulsive game. And lots of people did spend a lot of time playing it.
They certainly did. I played against a sort of a random stranger's 8-year-old on the train, and she managed to get really good score. I got zero. I just didn't have the mad skills, but it was massive amongst kids as well as across the sort of generational thing. Why do people torture themselves with
it's a crazy thing, and Keith Stewart wrote a really great piece about this whole thing back when Flappy Bird was around, which is that it's that you're on the edge of constantly being rewarded, so it always looks just so accessible. Oh, I'm just about to get, oh damn, that was just bad luck, because you know, I just, and this time it's going to be better. It's very like the sort of it's very like the way that roulette or any of the other sort of chance games in a casino work. And it's been proven, for example, there were studies back in World War II, which showed that if you took pigeons and you fed them food after they pecked a lever a set number of times, they would peck the levers just enough times to keep themselves fed. If you then changed it so that they would be delivered a piece of food randomly after a random number of pecks, even though you kept the average the same, they would peck far more because they liked the random, you know, they liked the sort of, hey, it might happen this time. You know, who knows how pigeons think, but that's the sort of effect. And that's rather how something like Flappy Bird works. You know, you're convinced that next time you're going to really do it. And it's interesting, I think, to compare this with some of the older games. At the weekend, I watched the film King of Kong, which is a fantastic film. I really recommend it to everyone. It's a documentary about a contest between the guy who had been the Donkey Kong King, if you like, for 20 years. He used to answer the phone with the phrase, "Hello, world record headquarters," because he was also the world champion for some other arcade game, and a guy who's a challenger. And it's all about, you know, it's very much about the personality. But one of the interesting sort of things about it is that people looked at the game, how Donkey Kong works, how the different screens are set out, what things you have to dodge, what you have to move around. And there's a lot of planning and thought and strategy and hand-eye coordination. Flappy Bird, and now, you know, Flappy Copter or whatever it's called, Swing Copter, boils all that away. There's none of that. It's really, you know, gaming with all the water taken out. This is just you and a couple of little things and just endless reward and frustration.
One other thing I think, which is really important for Flappy Bird as a craze, perhaps, rather than Flappy Bird, the app itself, is that it rapidly became an archetype. The game itself is so, so simple. A one-click, a one-tap game with one number that tells you how well or badly you do, one character, one thing to avoid, that the number of, firstly, clones, simple clones designed to cash in on the appeal, but then more interesting riffs on the theme began to emerge over the next month. It became like a jazz standard. People tweaking it, putting their own little thing on it. So firstly, you have the reskins. Then you have the other meme-based games. You had Flappy Doge, which puts a lovable Shiba Inu in the place of the dog. Then you have a mashup with the other big height of the early part of the year, 2048. So you have Flappy 2048, which puts you in the position of a flying number two trying to pick up other twos and fours and eights and 16s. It goes on and on. And the multiplayer one was genuinely wonderful to watch. Everyone playing Flappy Bird at the same time, starting at the same time, and the thing goes on until the last person dies. You crash out at number five and have to watch someone else flapping their way to the end. It was marvellous, and it, I think, deservedly contributed to that.
Very briefly,
phenomenon.
Charles.
And I think it's just really interesting to compare what Alex says about it, you know, becoming the sort of the jazz standard of games, with the other gigantic hit on mobile this year, which has been Monument Valley, written by Us Two Games, which you don't see clones of that. You know, it's sort of Escherian, sort of ethereal, a weird little, quite short game, but really fascinating. You know, the soundtrack has been released. You can get posters of the artwork. You know, a beautiful game. No one's copying that because it's just too hard. And yet, you know, both of those have been enormous money earners. Both have made enormous names for their creators. And yet the interesting thing is that, you know, I think that you'll see only a few Monument Valley-style things, whereas, you know, Flappy Bird, Swing Copters, there's going to be a bazillion of them.
Well, Swing Copter is released, I believe you said, Alex, in the next week or so. Mm-hmm. So we shall see if it is as big a hit as Flappy Bird. And Charles, that study that you referenced is B.F. Skinner's Superstition of the Pigeon. Very, very interesting psychological study. In the meantime...
It would be Skinner,
wouldn't it? It has to do with birds and putting things in boxes. Anyway, in the meantime, get everything you need to get done before Swing Copter is released.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
Here's a truism. iPod has been overtaken by smartphones and streaming. Discuss. Well, something that seems to be hanging on from that era, like a piece of gum attached to a tooth that's just about to fall out, is the MP3, the ubiquitous file format for music and audio. But even its days are numbered, according to Lynn Music, independent publishers and hardware manufacturers based in Glasgow since 1982. The era of the high-res music download is close at hand. Admittedly, it does need a snappier title. For Tech Weekly, Guardian tech reporter Samuel Gibbs met Gilad Tiefenbrum, managing director of Lynn Products, to find out why he feels our music listening needs an upgrade.
So from Lynn's point of view, you know, we've been recording music at higher than CD quality since 99. In that respect, it's the original studio master. It's what the artist chose to be the thing that they released to the public. In which case, then, why shouldn't it be reproduced at that? It's logical to me that if we've got the equipment, which we've had probably since 2007, then why not? Why wouldn't you deliver that direct to the customer's home? In effect, you're giving people the option to access directly what the artist or orchestra has recorded.
So essentially what you're saying is, now that we have the technology, that technology is caught up, there's no reason not to.
Yeah, I mean, often cited would be things like hard drive storage capacity, download bandwidth, but these constraints are fast loosening. And actually, for most people, we've got terabytes of storage now, so the reason to store a load of MP3s isn't quite there. Everyone's got plenty of space, really, to store thousands of studio masters. And in most developed countries, broadband is really pervasive, in which case you can easily download a studio master. And so the arguments that led to the creation of MP3 are gradually falling away. And it's kind of inevitable from my point of view that record labels will more often now, more and more, make the studio masters available, even for back catalogue content, as we're seeing from the likes of Universal. And people will start to, more and more as they are, purchase the original studio master, and then they'll be seeking a way to actually play that at home and on their portable devices.
So the high-res music, as it seems to be being called, at least in the technology circles, kind of came into focus with Neil Young's Pono player. That was the one thing. And no matter what you think of the Pono player, for us, it's a bit of an odd device. It's a triangle music player. Who wants a triangle music player? What do you think of what Neil Young is trying to do there?
So I actually spent some time with Neil Young about 3 years ago when he was formulating the idea for this. And because we'd had our Studio Master download site for a few years prior to that, then I was one of the obvious people for him to speak to as he was trying to figure out what ultimately became Pono. And for me, it was never about and isn't about the player. It's actually about the 24-bit music store. And the player is a focal point because people will understand the concrete more easily than they'll understand the abstract. And so for people to understand what this 24-bit music store is about, then I think the publicity generated by the Kickstarter campaign and getting people to pledge for the product has done exactly the right job. It's said to people, buy into this idea, show the industry there's backing for this thing, because Neil Young has to get all the majors on board, because he doesn't just want to release a very small quantity of music. He wants access to for the Pono Store to the entire back catalogue of all the majors. And in the process of working with Neil Young, who I was introduced to from the CEO of Atlantic Records, you realise that it's all there. The majors have this treasure trove, this enormous goldmine of 24-bit music in back catalogue. It is going to come out. Naturally, they just want to figure out how they can monetize it the best, and they want to figure out how Apple's not going to get all of the pie like they did with iTunes. As the old saying goes, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So the majors are hoping that this Pono Music Initiative will actually give them a larger share of the digital download pie. And in effect, this is actually their last chance, because they call it the crown jewels. This is the original recordings we're talking about. Once it's out there, they can't put it back in again. So this is maybe the last hurrah for them in terms of monetizing their enormous back catalogues, a huge commercial opportunity. There've been a few trials. I mean, we did a deal with Universal and we host a selection of their back catalogue. And so they take the odd 24-bit studio master that they've got. I mean, it's a big amount of music for us. For them, it's a drop in the ocean. And they've been trying out, you know, is it profitable for them? And there's some... Over the past 7 years, more and more websites have sprung up in the Lynn Records mold. Sites like HD Tracks in the States, which I believe is going to launch in the UK, Kobo's in France, Hi-Res Downloads, I think, is one as well. So there's a number of these different sites that have sprung up. And so they've figured out, you know, what's the market, that, you know, is it profitable? And I think now the next thing we're going to see happen is this PonoMusic.com is the first kind of major global kind of download store that will actually be the real attempt to productize it on a grand scale. And so going back to the Neil Young thing, I think the player is a total distraction. I have ordered one. I am excited about it. But I think, yeah, it's not going to be a massive consumer electronics success. However, the music store... Well, that could save the record industry, in fact.
Traditionally, when we think of music labels, especially from looking from the outside, it's always there are so many great ideas, but there's always such difficulty getting the great ideas working. Do you think that we are finally at the position where they will actually pull their finger out, make it happen, and make Hi-Res an actual thing that every company is doing?
Well, one of the problems, of course, is just even in the terminology. So no one can agree what Hi-Res is one problem, because they used to call, some companies call the 320 kilobit MP3 Hi-Res. Some people say, no, it has to be CD quality to be Hi-Res, and some people say it has to be 24-bit. So one of the things that I advised Neil Young on was to come up with to use the studio master term to say, well, it's what the artist recorded that matters. Now, that's going to be fundamental in answer to your question about whether it will stick with the public. It has to be something that people can understand, relate to, because if they're confused, they aren't going to buy it.
How does the man on the street who's trying to buy something good, something really good, what they think of as Hi-Res, how do they discern between what is Hi-Res and what's just called Hi-Res?
That's going to be a challenge. I think certain things are going to be taken care of if the Pono Music site comes out and others follow suit, notably iTunes. I mean, I think it's inevitable iTunes will follow suit and ultimately will be a 24-bit site. It's down to these people to educate through marketing something to the public. They have to educate the public on these differences. Now, it used to be commonplace in the 60s, 70s for people to understand that if you spent more money on a record player, it would sound better. The industry then spent a lot of years through the CD years telling people that it was good enough if you just spent 100 quid on a CD player. Now, then they told everyone it was good enough if you just bought an MP3 player. Mm. They now have to spend a lot of time and money undoing the damage that those messages have caused to tell people actually it is worth paying that little bit more, because it will be a little bit more inevitably for a 24-bit file. And it is worth spending a bit more money buying a 24-bit capable player. The other thing you're going to have going on at the same time is your mobile phone will start to have 24-bit enabled hardware inside it. And we're seeing that with, I believe, LG are doing something in that regard. And inevitably, others will follow suit. And the underlying chipsets and operating systems will be 24-bit capable. They'll also play their role, the likes of Google and Amazon, I guess, will get in on the act. And certainly Apple at educating and explaining to the customers, explaining to the public what you're going to get when you buy into high res, however they describe it, however they market it.
So somebody buys a Studio Master and they want to play it. At the point at which you've got that file, is the hardware up to it? Say I've got the file on my phone. My phone is one of the latest flagship smartphones. Is that good enough to actually realize the quality of the audio?
In one respect, you could just use that new 24-bit smartphone and stick headphones into the audio jack and it'll sound better. Turn on the Bluetooth and use a high-quality Bluetooth connection to a Bluetooth speaker. It'll sound better again. Stream those files through a hi-fi system, it'll sound even better again. So there's going to be a lot of options, but the baseline is, yeah, it'll sound better, and then you can then explore from there. And I actually think people's interest will be piqued in high-quality audio in the way that it hasn't been for a long, long time, especially younger people. And we see in our company, we still sell turntables, and we've seen quite an uptick in turntable sales over the past couple of years, as I think all the hi-fi manufacturers have. And that's because DJs are generally like experimenting now with vinyl versus MP3 and finding that vinyl is a better sonic result for them. That leads to a revival of interest in quality, which I think this 24-bit download thing will feed upon. And so the logical next step then is for younger people to become interested in higher res downloads.
At the moment, where most people are using either AAC or MP3s, and both of those are beholden to some sort of licensing agreement, do you think the use of open formats is likely to push the thing along better because there's nobody to pay a licensing fee and it's going to make it more open?
Undoubtedly, because when you've got an open format, you can store your record collection in the digital world in one coherent library. When everything's all mixed up in different formats and you're tied in with either certain equipment or certain service providers, then you get in the kind of muddle like when the Virgin Media download service fell apart a few years back and you lose part of your collection. I don't think people will tolerate that anymore. So I think the open format aspect is vital for pervasive success. And I think that's been proven in all kinds of technological realms that actually for anything to be a long-term sustainable success these days, it has to be open.
And so these days, when we think of music consumption, a lot of people plonk for Spotify because they don't own their own music collections anymore. They are effectively buying a license to others. Do you think the streaming model and almost the rental model is compatible with Studio Master?
Yeah, definitely. I think we'll see download services like Spotify and Google Play moving up the quality level as they have been, and they'll track that. There's no reason why they wouldn't want to improve the quality of their product. Likewise, Apple and iTunes. It's actually the major record labels that have been the bottleneck, and it's up to how quickly they release the music that has been the determining factor as to whether this is available. Again, it comes down to, can they monetize it? They're terrified that it'll all be pirated and given away for free, and they've given away their crown jewels, so they have to come up with the commercial model to go with it.
We have links to Lynn Music on our blog and Samuel's article on his comparison of the MP3, the CD, and Lynn's high-res music download. That's at theguardian.com/techweekly. We're taking a short summer break now to recharge the batteries and get ready for our new season of Pods. Remember, though, for the best tech news and reviews 24/7, all you have to do is go to theguardian.com/technology. Do follow us on Twitter @GuardianTW, and we'll keep you posted on the new shows there. Tech Weekly will be back mid-September. Until then, from me, Alex Krotowski, our producer, Jason Phipps, and all the tech team, thank you very much for listening. Have a great rest of the summer, and we'll see you in a month.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.